extent, we're familiar with your cases. I think you're familiar with our lighting system. As long as you have a green light, you're running free. When the yellow light appears, you should begin to bring your argument to a close. And then when the red light appears, you should finish your sentence and stop. And the clock on your side of the podium will tell you how many minutes you have left. And I remind you that rebuttal is for rebuttal only. We call the first case U.S. v. Lucas et al., and we hear first from Mr. Collette.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. As the Court has indicated, and of course we are re-urging all the issues in the brief, but for purposes of timing today, I want to tell the Court this is not your typical mortgage loan case. At the time, Countrywide Home Loans was in the business of making loans. They didn't care about employees' credibility, employees' source of down payment, et cetera. They were in the business of generating as many loans as possible. So based on that, what we've argued, what we think is primary, is in this three-week trial, I represented Kim Castle. She was the closing attorney. The government said throughout that basically the fraud was complete. They had false applications from the get-go. They had people at Countrywide, Rosie Barnes, one of their witnesses, was taking money to make these applications. She also was sat on the grand jury. Obviously, she didn't hear this case, but it was strange. But she was taking money, and she said, well, it was a gift from Richard Lucas. So from inception, you had improprieties at Countrywide, their own employees. I asked her, how come you're not even indicted? And the government says later, well, the investigation's ongoing. It's been 3 years. They haven't indicted Rosie. In fact, great to know she's working back at a bank. In any event, you take that, you had bogus W-2s, you had bogus employee checks. All of this stuff was fraudulent. My client's role was to prepare the HUDs, and we tried to assert that all the HUDs were was a recording of the money in and the money out. Now, one of the things that concerned us, Your Honors, and again, if the Court has any specific areas, I'll certainly address that. But in closing, I submitted that the government had an improper closing. My client didn't take the stand. And the government said, now she wants to turn this blind eye and say she's not involved. She doesn't know, I objected, what's going on. I says, Judge, that's improper. Judge Sterritt, great, great judge. He was a state court judge. I've known him for years. It's hard to come up here today and say he messed up on the conviction, but he did real good on the ruling. So I guess my position is he did great, but he just didn't go far enough. Judge Sterritt said, all right, it's final argument, proceed. He didn't sustain my objection, which I asked about. The next thing they say is, I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, referring to my client, she got money outside of HUDs. There was not a shred of evidence that said she got any money outside of HUDs. I objected again, improper closing, Judge. There was no money there. And he says, I don't recall any testimony outside of closing, sustains the objection. You
had a chance in argument to discuss that, did you not? In closing argument, you would have had an opportunity to discuss.
No, that was rebuttal, Judge. That was rebuttal. In other words, yes, sir, that was Ms. Haynes, and she did it on rebuttal, and I didn't have time. The other thing is I see on the yellow light. Certainly, we assert all the rest of the insufficiency of the evidence. The big thing is the loss amount. I went and pulled actual deeds from the courthouse, and it showed that Countrywide got money on some of these properties that was different from what they utilized in the trial. We never litigated. We didn't have a chance to cross-examine because loss wasn't an issue during the trial of this case. That I submit, and even Judge Sterritt said, he asked probation, he asked everybody, how am I to pick a number if y'all not going to tell me what to go by?
You got a chance to refute what was in the PSR, though, didn't you?
I did, and I went to based on that, which was all their chart. It was a chart by Countrywide. We went to the courthouse, pulled the record, and when it said 309 West Street in Hattiesburg, it said sold for $80,000. I go back to the PSR, and it says $60,000 loss. Well, that can't be right. Well, they say, well, that may have been a different time. No, no, no. I got the deeds in rebutting the pre-sentence report, as this Court has said. The district judges can presume the pre-sentence reports are valid and reasonable and adopt them, unless rebutted. I gave Judge Sterritt those documents. He should have, I think, Your Honors, he should have just continued the sentencing, had a hearing just on that. He acknowledges he got the documents. He acknowledges he just got them that morning, which was our fault, certainly. Now, the other aspect is on count 12 was the money laundering. We didn't know at the time we did the charge conference that he was going to grant it. And so it's hard to say what the jury found. He threw out the bank fraud object of the conspiracy, and he threw out the false statement object of the conspiracy. The only thing that remained was the wire fraud. We did not have a specific interrogatory slash verdict as to count 12. So count 12, the jury may have relied on the bank fraud provision that was subsequently dismissed. I think that was error. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Okay. Mr. Davis?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Jim Davis. I'm a lawyer from Gulfport, and I represent Ken Stallnaker in the trial and on this appeal. Ken Stallnaker was the appraiser that was in this case that got convicted, and there's no doubt some bad things went on as far as Richard Lucas and these loan applications and what he did. I hope y'all kind of caught from the facts that Mr. Lucas was in the used car business and preparing fake W-2s and fake documents to get people loans for cars or used cars, seemingly that's acceptable in some state, in some form of the used car business. So somebody recruited him to start doing mortgage loans the same way, and that's where he got this mentality that he could just do fake documents and anything else to help people buy fake property and close loans. But as far as all the bad things he did, and he did a ton of them, my client didn't have anything to do with all the bad things that Richard Lucas did. My client, the only thing he did was appraisals.
Well, I picked up in the brief that there's some evidence that Lucas would tell him what he wanted the property appraised at, and Stallnaker would give it to him.
Correct, and I think that was raised by Malcolm Clark. Then I went right back and pointed out to Mr. Clark. I listed, I think three or four different properties, and I said, well, if that's true, Mr. Clark, let's see what Mr. Lucas asked him to give for this particular tract. And when I did that, it was obvious that Mr. Stallnaker's appraisers many times were below the price that Mr. Lucas was asking for. And I think it's common business for someone to call an appraisal up and say, listen, I need some appraisal on some property. See what you can do for me. And, I hate to say this, I may want a high appraisal or a low appraisal. Try to help me out as much as you can with this. Also, Clark admitted himself after he worked for Lucas, he would call my client up and say, listen, I'm thinking about buying some property out in such and such street. Give me some comps out there, meaning some comparable properties out there so I can compare that in my mind to see if I'm getting a good deal. That's kind of what businessmen do all the time. Lucas would just kind of say, listen, I'm trying to close this property. Is it potentially worth $70,000 or $80,000? That's what I want to, try to buy this for. Let me know if the appraisal is going to come in around that. Sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't. I don't think Ken Stallnaker based his appraisals strictly off what Richard Lucas wanted. He had to go out and find comparables, which he did. Malcolm Clark testified that he wasn't preparing bogus appraisals. He was preparing legal, legitimate appraisals that were based off comparable properties.
Did his appraisals list the comparables, or did
you? Oh, yes, they did. They listed the comparable properties. The appraisal expert that the government called, Stan Lightsey, admitted none of his comparables out of all these properties, none of his comparables were bogus. They were legitimate contracts or sales that had taken place on properties. He just said he felt like my client was inflating the values. He kind of overstated them, and he found comparables that he felt were a little bit higher. But as I pointed out, that's just an opinion. That's your opinion that he is inflating the value of this property.
Was there testimony or evidence about incidents in which the appraisal came back less than what Lucas had asked for?
Correct, yes. Oh, Malcolm Clark, I went through about three or four different sales, and I said, Lucas was hunting for a contract sales price. I forget the three tracks, but it's in his testimony, and I pointed it out in my brief, three different tracks where he said, I want X amount. Your client came in, the appraisal came in for a lot less than that. The government's response to, all they had is Stan Lightsey and Malcolm Clark. Those are the only witnesses that ever took the stand and said anything bad about my client. The government's response to that was the appraisals sometimes on the same date as the appraisal, Lucas was buying the property for a substantially less value. Example, Lucas would buy the property for $47,000. On that exact same date, my client would do an appraisal for $88,000. And, of course, that looks bad. When you say, that's bad, that looks bad. But here's the flip side about it. In their brief, they point out, my client had knowledge of all these sales that Lucas was buying with these property with the deflated prices and everything. There was no proof that my client had any knowledge of those. No proof whatsoever. And the only way he would have gotten the knowledge is if Richard Lucas would told him.
How much was he paid for each appraisal?
$400, $500. Of course, they contend that was an inflated price for appraisals. And I think it's just like anything. Anything's negotiable. If you can get a decent price for your work, you're gonna do it.
You've got a red light.
I appreciate
it. Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Cleveland. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Gaines Cleveland with the Gulfport branch of the U.S. Attorney's Office, and with me at counsel table is Glenda Haynes, who was a trial counsel with me in the court below. Let me turn first to Mr. Colletti's points on behalf of Defendant Kessel. He talks about his client, Kim Kessel, as only preparing the HUDs. Well, her role was to close the loans, and the proof at trial was that she manipulated this process in a way that defrauded the lender, in the sense that the lender expected to have a down payment for the property. She prepared HUDs that indicated that there were down payments that were made for the properties, when in fact the down payments came from not the borrower, but from Defendant Lucas. And she helped accomplish this process in part by releasing the loan proceeds in advance of receiving the down payment. So you can see the evidence of trial where loan payments would come in. You could actually see the evidence of the loan payments being taken to the bank, being used to purchase the down payments, and then the down payment money coming back after the proceeds had been released, which completely reverses the process. She also was there at both ends of these transactions, the purchase of the properties at the front end, and then sometimes the almost immediately resale of the properties for nearly double the value. So she was fully aware of numerous aspects of the scheme, and she lent herself to this process wholly.
She would have, she then would have seen the paperwork, including all the amounts for the first transaction and then the resale.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Right? So she would know if a property was immediately resold for a much greater.
That is correct. In fact, if I might jump to a point that Mr.
How many of those transactions were there?
We only focused on 40 some odd transactions at trial for the purposes of simplifying this case for the jury. Ultimately, there was only one that went to the jury involving Superior Federal Alliance funding, and all of the rest were countrywide loans. We made up binders of relevant documents, tabbed binders, so the jury could see how all these documents related to one another, and we picked 40-some-odd properties for this purpose.
Over what period of time?
It would have been during the time frame of the conspiracy. We have it as starting in December of 2000 and running through November 30th, 2002. Let me jump to this point because it does relate directly to the question of, about what Ms. Castle knew, because it also impacts on what Ms. Stallnaker knew. You can look at the appraisals, and I, certainly somebody looking at these appraisals should have realized what was going on from the standpoint of the lender, but that's not what the case is about. You can look at the Stallnaker appraisals. For example, there's a Government Exhibit 22D, and you compare that to another document in that same exhibit, where Stallnaker knows on January 29th of 2002 that a certain property it has been bought for the last time it's the transaction had been with $31,000. He appraises it the same day at $67,000. And his source of that information is not Lucas, it happens to be Castle. And we have other examples of those sort of transactions throughout the record where Stallnaker knows the initial transfer price and immediately turns around and appraises it for.
On page 21 of your brief, you have the bullets listing a number of transactions, and counsel just said that there's no evidence that Mr. Stallnaker knew any of this.
Well, that absolutely it happens not to be true, as borne out by the record. And if you will look at each one of those bullet points at the exhibits that are cited, you will find whenever it says that Stallnaker knew, there actually is a reference in the document that indicates that Stallnaker knew. With respect to the objections as to the closing statements and rebuttal that were touched on, the statement with respect to Castle wanting to turn a blind eye, as stated by the counsel for the prosecution in rebuttal, this was a passing reference. It was not manifestly intended to be any sort of a comment on the failure of Ms. Castle to testify. There was no showing that there's any sort of a clear effect on the jury. As to this reference to money being paid outside of closing, the judge sustained the objection on that point, so I don't really see what the issue is on appeal. But in fact, if you do go back and look at the record in the transcript of Malcolm Clark's testimony at pages 63 and 664, it's in fact true that counsel for the government did make reference to something that was in the records. There was a reference to money being paid outside of closing, but that's neither here nor there. On the issue of the loss amount, Mr. Coletti says that he didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine the witness on this point. He may have chosen not to. It may not have been the time for him to pursue it, but this actually was developed during the government's case in chief. There was a witness, Chris Raycraft, from Countrywide, who testified, and she authenticated what became Government Exhibit 74A of what are called screenshots. The Countrywide business records had a record of all of these properties that had gone into foreclosure, the ones that were the focus of the government's case, and she had the amount of the original loan on this document, and also the amount that was generated as a result of the foreclosure. Now, in this case, all of the foreclosure sales were set off against the loan amounts. So there was, in fact, a set off. And the judge did this set off in a way that relied upon Countrywide business records. Now, Mr. Coletti came in fairly at the last minute with some other document that I don't think anybody ever really understood how it correlated to what were the ordinary business records of Countrywide, and I think the judge acted entirely appropriately in discounting that.
Let me just ask you this. Was there an issue at trial whether Countrywide was encouraging these loans?
Not really, in the sense, I mean, they clearly were fairly aggressive in their loan practices, but there was nothing untoward other than what Mr. Colletti has referred to. We did become aware of one of the loan individual who was not involved in authorizing loans had gotten some payments from Lucas, but they were fairly. They were substantial amounts, but not so much that there was any basis for showing that she did anything in exchange for those, because she really was not in a position to do any exchange for those. And Mr. Colletti,
do you have a case of bank fraud if the entity you're dealing with is encouraging the loans for below value collateral?
You can, although we don't have any evidence of that anything was done. There was absolute fraud on the part of Richard Lucas and everybody that was in collusion with him as part of this case. There was never any showing that anybody who was a decision maker at the bank, the lender, Countrywide, did anything that they wouldn't have done otherwise. I mean, I think they may have been sloppy, but that does not exonerate defendants who knowingly engage in efforts to manipulate the process. I'll save the balance of my time.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay, Mr. Colletti.
And we submit, Judge, Countrywide was not only sloppy, it was criminal. Aggressive? Fairly aggressive? Sure. Look at the documents we submitted. It says that Countrywide has a check sheet. They made this big thing in front of the jury about source of the down payment. Countrywide's internal document says source of down payment, and they checked N.A. throughout the case. They didn't care about the source of the down payment.
How was this issue presented to the jury, if it was?
Just like that. I had the documents. There was a Countrywide lady on there. I said, Miss Jones, are these your forms? Yes. Can you read this to the jury? Source of down payment. N.A. What does that mean? It means it wasn't applicable in that case.
All right, did you get a charge on it or ask for a charge on it?
Instruction? No, not on that, Judge. No, not on that issue. But, I mean, it was part of our case that certainly Countrywide didn't care. Also, every one of these so-called victims, you understand you had an IRS analyst and the lady who cleaned Judge Starrett's office. Judge Starrett didn't know about it until the middle of the case. That they were investors. These weren't people needing a house. These were people who wanted to make money. They were going to make money. This lady from Washington with IRS flew down twice and got $8,000-$9,000 to go back up. This was a great deal. Did they say encouraging? They didn't care, Judge. It was one of the ladies testified that she made like $200,000 or $300,000 because her salary was subject to the percentage of the loans they closed. Now going back to that's that whole down payment theory that really, in a pure sense, yes, you want equity. They got the money. I submit to you they can't trace that it was that money because of Regulation CC. This whole issue, though, about Castle turning a blind eye, Your Honor, the judge did not sustain it. He said, move along, this is closing, and again, it's an inference that certainly she didn't testify.
Did you press for a ruling on it?
Your Honor?
Did you press for a ruling?
No, Your Honor. I asked the judge, I objected to it, and he said, well, it's closing, and you know, again, I had to object four times during closing. I mean, by that time, after 3 weeks, the jury's usually tired of listening to me because I've objected too many times, and they say, I wish that little fat guy would sit down. But I hate doing it during closing, but in this particular case, I had to do it four times. Your Honor, the other thing, and I touched briefly about it, he mentioned the loss amount and where I came up with these documents. Albeit it was late, but I mean, again, we were trying to get some of the documents. These were actual trustee deeds, and they just didn't want to look at it. Judge says, you know, I understand, and he started doing some credit, but then he just said, well, it's reasonable, and let's go. And I'll be honest with the court. I got a ways to go because the cutoff is 400 to a million. He used plus a million, and so I've got a little ways to go there. But again, I think part of the argument with the sentencing was that the government manipulated these cases with the co-defendants. There were 13 people. They did exactly what the guidelines were supposed to be imposed to prevent, and that is Philip Weary, their own agent, said originally, the FBI said, he was the main guy. He got 18 months. He got a minimal rule. Thank you all very much.
All right. Thank you, sir. Okay, Mr.
Davis.
Yes,
I'll be real brief and just touching on one thing Your Honor asked, was Countrywide active in recruiting these loans? That's what I was pointing out, that Richard Lucas was in the used car business, and he did such a good job getting people to make loans with Superior Bank that they were the ones that recruited him and said, you need to go into the real estate business because we feel like you're doing such good in getting us loans on cars. Why don't you go get us some loans on real estate? And, of course, that led to this overall disaster. But also I'll point out, Judge, that all the proof at trial was primarily about Richard Lucas and his wrongdoing, very little on Kenneth Stallnaker. And that also kind of goes to my motion. I did request a severance. It was repeatedly denied. There was little proof against Mr. Stallnaker.
What about the government's brief, page 21? They had the bullets. It said, okay, here are the documents. He knew that was sold on such and such date, and a few days later he appraised it for almost double the amount. What about that?
Again, any knowledge he came from Richard Lucas primarily, and trusting Richard Lucas. And as I pointed out, I don't think you could really trust Richard Lucas on much of anything. I don't think he was a very credible person. And just by chance, as far as this particular issue goes, Mr. Stallnecker's in the courtroom, and I confronted him this morning about this. And without testifying to what he said, again, I'll just stick with my original argument that any information he acquired primarily came from Richard Lucas. And I don't think you could trust Richard Lucas on anything he says. And again, the proof at trial was primarily all focused on Lucas, very little on Mr. Stallnaker. And, oh, I see my red light's on.
Thank you, sir.
Yep.
All right, Mr. Cleveland, back to you.
All right. We'll be bouncing up and down a little bit here, yep. Your Honors. I appreciate it. We ask you now to turn to the issue of bank fraud. There is no basis to doubt that a scheme to defraud the parent corporations of Countrywide Home Loans and Alliance Funding is prohibited by the Bank Fraud Statute, Section 1344. A bank holding company such as the Countrywide parent qualifies as a financial institution even without FDIC insurance.
Let me tell you what I'm interested in, and that is, I mean, you do have to prove, and the jury had to find that this fraud was with the intent to defraud the parent. That was what the charge said, and what I want to know is what evidence you have that there was intent to defraud the two parent companies.
With respect to Alliance Funding, there were documents in the record that always indicated that Alliance Funding was a subsidiary of Superior. So it was, and everybody spoke about Alliance Funding to being part and parcel of Superior.
This was in the closing document?
That's correct. And let me actually have the
I mean, none of these defendants had any dealings with any representative of the parent company, as I take it.
Well, I mean, Countrywide, as the testimony developed at trial, is, of course, a nationwide lender based in California. And we had the executive vice president of Countrywide come out to Hattiesburg to testify.
This is the parent company?
He's with the parent company. And he said that the Countrywide Home Loans is basically an alter ego of the parent company. And he went through various reasons why they have a very close relationship. They share their leadership. They file consolidated financial statements. He said that the losses to the subsidiary Countrywide Home Loans were borne dollar for dollar by the Countrywide parent. And I'm not sure I fully accept the proposition that there has to be an intention to affect the specific intention to affect the parent.
That's what the charge said. I read the charge.
Well, there was evidence, you know, that Countrywide was all the documents refer to Countrywide of California. There's a specific document with respect to Alliance and Superior. Lexi, all the documents refer to them as being a subsidiary of Superior Bank. And, for example, Government Exhibit 2A is a broker fee sheet, talks about Alliance Funding Division of Superior Bank, and then there was testimony at trial that equated them. But you don't need to find that the, for example, Countrywide Home Loans is a covered entity, because if the statute reads that if it prohibits schemes to obtain money owned by a financial institution by means of fraud, then in this case, with Countrywide being the primary operating subsidiary and losses affecting the parent on a dollar-for-dollar basis, that is effectively what the defendants accomplished in this case. There also is the issue that Judge Sterik referred to of a federal nexus. And if you look at the regulatory structure, the statutory structure for bank holding companies, there's a strong federal interest in the activities of the subsidiaries of bank holding companies. The Bank Holding Company Act provides that the parent company has to report on the status of the subsidiaries. The subsidiaries are subject to examination as to their financial condition, because there's a strong interest in the viability of the subsidiaries.
Let me ask you one other thing about the Alliance. There was only one count involving Alliance?
Actually, it's not separated by count, but there was only one loan at the end of the day that was that's correct.
Okay. Was there anything in the loan documents in the Alliance transaction that mentioned Superior Bank?
Yes, the one that I just referenced. It's Exhibit 2A, and there are others in that Exhibit 2 series. All the loan documents relating to particular loans were behind a tab in an exhibit binder, and everything behind tab 2 related to that loan. And so you'll find multiple documents in Exhibit 2 series behind tab 2 that make that specific reference.
You say the loan documents referred to the parent in both the Countrywide transactions and the Alliance transactions.
I can't. The Countrywide documents, you're not going to see much of a reference to, by name, Countrywide Financial Corporation. That really wasn't the face of Countrywide. The witness from Countrywide said the face of Countrywide, the alter ego, is Countrywide Home Loans.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Coletti.
You know, in answer to the court's question, the only thing they had, and what they're trying to sneak in here on, is on the loan application of Susan Bourgeois and on Janet Chapman's, which the one that couldn't testify, the cleaning lady, they had a logo on there, Alliance Funding Superior. And this court has said logo's not enough. You got to have a little more. This court has spoken about this, has warned the prosecutors that you got to prove the jurisdictional issue. That's number one. Number two, they then said, and they tried to get in below, about the certificate. Well, the FDI certificate for Superior Bank somehow magically morphs into covering Alliance. This court again has said certificate may cover branches, but it's not going to cover an entity very similar to Charles Schwab in the Odonato, if I'm speaking correctly. But in any event, this court has ruled that Charles Schwab was not covered under the federal statute. Now, with respect to Countrywide, never, ever, ever was the parent even mentioned. And understand the timing. Mr. Cleveland, in his brief and here again today, said Brian Sewer said it was an alter ego. No, he didn't. Gaines Cleveland said it was an alter ego and just said, isn't that right? And he said, well, you know, it's known by this deal. So Brian Sewer didn't testify that. You got a timing problem too, Your Honors. The reserve order is not dated until April of 01. He's got loans in there that were back to 2000. Countrywide simply was not covered. And he talks about Judge Sterritt. We looked at this from pretrial, through trial, whatever. Judge Sterritt, I wanted him to grant this motion prior to going to the jury because we could clean out a lot of the stuff. He held it, which I believe the Rule 29 allows him to do. In his brief, he says, Alliance funding was closely associated. There's not a testimony of that. No one from Superior came to court. No one from Alliance came to court. They got this document in, and they're trying to do nothing more than a logo, and somehow they said it was closely associated because that's what they wanted. Countrywide Home Loans, totally different story. They go through a series of – what they did, Your Honors, was they bought a bank. The parent company bought Treasury Bank in D.C. in 01, and they wanted to be a bank holding company because of that entity. Had nothing to do with this. And the testimony was that Countrywide Home Loans was not like a mortgagee and we think of. They serviced the stuff. They got money from private investors. They made these loans and they sold these loans. Unfortunately, I got a Countrywide loan as we speak. But I mean, these were not, it wasn't like going to First National Bank and getting a loan. Countrywide was a volume. Just look at the internet, look at the paper. Everybody in earth right now knows, we didn't know then. They got sued for $80 billion. We didn't know what Countrywide was doing. As far as they can't be a victim, they were should have been a co-defendant. I obviously agree that Judge Sterritt took great pains at this issue and made the right ruling. And I'm not here that often saying that the district judge did that. Thank you all.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Davis.
Yes. I may real briefly just join in what John said and point out I'm not real swift on this particular issue, but I believe that for a federal court to have jurisdiction, it's got to be a federally chartered or insured financial institution, and this court has repeatedly ruled that the fraud in this case, the person that was charged, did not fall into that category, so therefore you don't have jurisdiction, and I believe Mr. Colletti has always pointed that out to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis, you're court appointed, and the court appreciates very much your services to your client and to this court. Okay, thank you. We have your case. Mm-hmm. Mr. Cleveland, you have some rebuttal, don't you?
Yeah, okay. Yes, I'll be very brief, Your Honor. We never took the position that Mr. Colletti's mentioning that the FDIC certificate for Superior itself covered Alliance as it would a branch of Superior. Our position has always been that exactly what I articulated at the outset, which is that Superior qualifies. It is, in fact, an FDIC insured entity, it was at the time. Countrywide Home Loans, the parent company, is a bank holding company, and we simply have taken the position that the close relationship between the mortgage lending subsidiary and the parent was sufficient to qualify for the reasons that we explained. Mr. Davis says, well, you've got to have a chartered entity, you've got to have insurance, depository insurance, and that simply is no longer the law. Section 20 of that defines what a financial institution is was amended in a way that recognized entities such as bank holding companies on equal footing as FDIC insured entities. We went through the factors with the executive vice president of Countrywide at pages 285 through 287 of the transcript in which we he described for the jury the close relationship between the mortgage lending subsidiary and the bank holding company, and we believe that is sufficient for the jurisdiction.
So you're to establish that the fraud here was committed with intent to defraud the parent on the Countrywide count, you say that is sustainable because of a Countrywide mortgage or was a subsidiary, was an alter ego of Countrywide Financial?
That's correct. That was the testimony of Brian Sue, who was the executive vice president who testified, and he testified on page 287 of the transcript that that Countrywide was, in essence, the alter ego of the parent. Let's say the home loans was the alter ego of the parent, that over 70% of the revenue stream came from the home loan subsidiaries.
But the statute doesn't say subsidiaries or, I mean, usually alter ego is a theory that's used to hold someone liable. In other words, the parent and the subsidiary. It's not normally is it used to here to say, well, someone defrauded a company. It turns out that that company's the alter ego of someone else. What evidence is there that the defendants knew of this alter ego relationship?
I'm not sure that they are that that is a specific requirement of the statute. I think that Section 1344 speaks of obtaining monies by fraud that are from the covered financial institution. That's the position that that we have, and I don't think that there's a specific knowledge requirement of the relationship between the subsidiary.
Is financial institution used in other banking statutes? Simply defined.
It's most clearly adopted for our purposes in the 1344. I mean, it specifically makes a cross reference to Section 20, which defines financial institution, and Section 20 has the different prongs of it. One for FDIC insured institutions, which is the traditional bank that this court has dealt with in virtually all of its rulings, and then 20, and then 6 in parentheses is a bank holding company. This court has not.
What I'm saying is, if we were, are there other similar definitions in other non-criminal statutes that this would have repercussions? In other words, if we were to say, well, it's a financial institution for this purpose, is that similarly defined elsewhere where they would get perhaps benefits under the laws as the, quote, alter ego, unquote, where they don't fall within the statutory definition?
We're not asking the court to redefine financial institution for any purpose. We want you to accept the definition of financial institution as it's written, including a bank holding company.
All I'm saying is if we were to say, well, alter egos are considered equivalent with the holding company, what repercussions, if any, does that have in other non-criminal areas?
I wish I could speak to that more meaningfully than I can, but I cannot. I do think that the court may find very helpful Judge Boudin's decision, which is in our brief, the Walsh decision from the First Circuit, which dealt with the relationship between a subsidiary and a bank parent. And Judge Boudin goes through why he does not believe there has to be intent on the part of the perpetrator to intend to affect the parent, so long as there is a relationship between the subsidiary and the parent. And he goes through various factors that a court can consider, and those are the factors that we've reviewed with
But we don't reach this issue if we affirm that.
We don't ask you to do that, Your Honor. We do ask you to. We filed our appeal of the Rule 29 adverse decision at a time when the other defendants who had pled guilty had pled guilty to bank fraud. We subsequently were able to negotiate entries of substitute pleas to wire fraud. That helped alleviate that issue. There really would not be a practical net effect. So if the court were to otherwise find the defendants appropriately guilty and convicted of the other counts, we would not be asking the court to reach the bank fraud issue.
That's so it wouldn't affect the sentence in any way?
It will not affect the sentencing in any way. It could potentially, I mean, it's a potential $100 special assessment, $100 special assessment for each of the two defendants.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have your case.